Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly
sex
show. Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school,
know about
pain and suffering,
learning and teaching.
In your face, in your face,
your
face.
Listen to your words that they be preaching. Cause here's the
Checkerfin.
Education gadfly show. Yeah. It's the Checkerfin. Education gadfly show.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, the loquacious Rick Hess.
Hey, babe, I like that, loquacious.
Isn't that nice?
That's one of those words, rapacious, voracious,
ooh.
Outrageous. Doesn't really rhyme, but it's still a fun word.
You know, I don't know. I think maybe the next time we do a rap for our intro to the podcast, you should probably do, you know, bust a rhyme.
Or we could do like a word jumble on the air. Can you do a word jumble on a podcast?
I don't know. I bet nobody's ever tried.
Probably.
So, Rick, you're like Mr. Globetrotter recently. You've been traveling here, there, all over the place. Would you like to share any stories from your many, many travels?
Yes. I would say that I found a fabulous seafood restaurant in Salem, Oregon the other day. Last Thursday night. The oysters, unbelievable.
You know, I like Salem. I got to go there once when I was in the government. And I just think it was the cutest little town.
It was adorable. I was speaking to... Oregon School Boards Association.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about collective bargaining issues. Mm-hmm. It was 9 a.m. and it was nonetheless quite fun.
Well, you know, Salem is definitely on my list of state capitals that it would be fun to work in someday because they're so nice. So there are other, you know, Denver would be another one. Santa Fe.
Is this your way of saying that if somebody wants to try to pry you away from Fordham's hands?
Hey, they want to send me to a beautiful town and let me do education policy and pay me a big salary? I would certainly consider it.
You sound like the president talking about his post-White House life.
Yeah, is that right? Well, let us know what you think your favorite state capitals are. You can send us a note at letters@edexcellence.net. We'd love to hear from you. We have a busy show today, Rick. As always, we're going to play a game of Pardon the Gadfly.
We have a busy show.
We do. It's jam-packed here. I mean, we keep going over. We used to promise that we would do it in 20 minutes or less. And recently, we keep going 21, 22. We need to stick to our word budget, Rick. All right. Then we've got an interview with the official voice on NAEP who will answer our tough questions. And then Liam will impart some education news of the weird. Sound good?
Works for me.
All right, Christina, let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
All right. Little Rock Central High School was integrated by federal troops 50 years ago this week. A new documentary shows that the school is still, in many ways, racially divided today. Rick, did Central High School drop the ball?
I'm not sure. I certainly think it's nice when, you know, kids of diverse backgrounds learn and play together. But
Rick, you've become so cautious ever since you started teaching at Harvard. Look, let me give you a little more context here. There's a documentary on HBO the other night about Little Rock High School, not so much about what happened 50 years ago, which was, of course, historic and important, but what's going on right now. And what they show is that the school is racially integrated, 50-50, but the white kids and the black kids don't tend to spend a lot of time together. For example, they don't hang out in the lunchroom together. More importantly, they are not in class together because the white students are much more likely to be in AP and honors classes and the black kids in the remedial classes, like is the case at a lot of American high schools.
But I got to say, the documentary is a little late to ball on this. I mean, Gary Orfield has been banging a drum on this for 30 odd years.
Well, Gary Orfield's point is that white from the Harvard Civil Rights Project. I guess now he's at maybe now he's in Berkeley.
Right, now he's out of Berkeley, I believe.
Yeah. All right, but he's been saying that white kids and black kids don't even go to the same school.
Right, but but we also know within schools that they enroll in different tracks, that African-American kids are disproportionately represented on special needs classes.
Well, we know that in the policy wonkery, okay? But I don't know if, you know, what this documentary does such a nice job of, and Liam wrote a great piece about it, is just showing up close what this looks like in a school. And what's frustrating is that the school, is concerned about it, but they seem to be doing silly things to address it. For example, I mean, and they have mix it up day where the kids are pushed to try to sit next to a child of a different race in the lunchroom, you know, rather than trying to address the core academic problems in class, in these classes that have a lot of African-American students, rather than trying to focus them on raising standards and core academics, they have these discussions, at least in the documentary, about whose fault it is that they're not doing well in school. Is it, you know, the white man's fault? Is it poverty's fault? Instead of teaching them math and reading and
English.
So do
you think those conversations don't have a place in the school?
I don't think those conversations are as important as trying to raise standards in the key subjects and trying to close the achievement gap. So, let's hope that maybe those conversations were
but
just going on.
But one of the proponents
the
of those standards say that of those conversations say that they engage the kids, they get them to care about school, and therefore they give you an opening to address the achievement gap.
All right, if that works, but at least the documentary didn't seem to make it clear that that was a small part of the strategy. That seemed to be
the strategy.
A lot of what was going on. Does that seem right, Liam? Yeah. Good. Christina, what's the next question?
All right. A parade of parents from Palo Alto protested prodigiously after the school board poo-pooed their presentation to procure a Mandarin immersion program. The parents pulled no punches. They threatened to start their own Mandarin charter school. The board, concerned about losing dollars to the charters, backed down and approved the immersion program. Mike, is this what charter schools were designed to do?
Well, in part, it's what they were designed to do. You know, charter schools are supposed to offer choices to parents. In some ways, it's supposed to, you know, even the playing field so that parents actually have some power within the public education system. I think this is fine if this is a way to get school boards' attention and be more responsive to the concerns of parents. Great. It doesn't mean school boards should always cave. They might call the bluff and say, go ahead and start your own school. We're not sure there's enough parents interested in Mandarin. But I think it's a fine bargaining chip for parents to use.
I think that's right. I mean, right, one of the challenges for school districts is they've got to serve everybody in the geographic area, which means you've got to make decisions about what's going to serve kids overall. And if you've got a population of kids or families that don't feel well served, you know, there's always been the question of how do they make sure that the district pays attention to their needs other than showing up and voting in the board election.
Right. Now, what was interesting about this story, and especially the headline, was it talked about cushy schools and cushy suburbs, that this is in Palo Alto, a very wealthy suburb where, of course, Stanford is. And there is a belief out there among some people that charter schools are supposed to just be for poor and minority kids. That is the case in many states where state law has designed them to be for poor and minority kids. But there's no reason that we can't have suburban or middle class charter schools also.
Now, I mean, there's a couple points here. I mean, one is this goes back to something we talked about a while back about this concern, are charters going to cream skim in an environment like this? Are families that want to enroll in Mandarin, are you going to siphon a lot of the quality conscious families out of this? Personally, I'm okay with this. I mean, I think you're exactly right. The other thing, though, is this kind of stuff gets misused sometimes by proponents of charter schooling, and they'll say, this shows the districts are competing. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest it's actually misreading. What we know is that if you're talking about an easily mimicked, easily emulated thing like offering a Mandarin program, it's much easier to get districts to do that. There's not a lot of evidence that the same district would have gone inside and re-engineered its approaches to key issues in response to pressure.
Well said, Rick.
Thank you, Bib.
Topic number three. Public Agenda recently released a survey. It shows that while parents and students think the U.S. is falling behind in math and science, far fewer think their own schools are doing a lousy job and need to change. Rick, what to make of this?
Well, they're probably right on at least one count.
What's that, Rick?
Well, they've been saying for probably 40-odd years now, parents have been telling pollsters that they're not real thrilled with how America's doing internationally, but they're very happy with their kids' school. And once again, the odds are they're probably right, either that their schools are pretty good or that we need to get better internationally, and perhaps they're right on both.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, Rick. I think that you're just too laissez-faire about this.
Explain.
Well, you know, look, what the survey showed is not only parents, but also students believe that they really didn't need to be taking more challenging courses. You know, and I think we've got now a lot of empirical evidence from many, many studies that our students are not learning at the same level as students from around the world. And that if you believe that at the very least we should be learning at the same level as students in our competitive countries, you know, then it seems like we need to raise the bar. So, frankly, I think the parents and students are probably wrong.
About
they
which?
Do need to be learning at higher levels, but they don't know that they need to be learning at higher levels.
But they're wrong about the quality of the school.
Yeah,
they're right that we need to do better internationally.
Okay, but they're wrong. What they are wrong about is that their own programs are rigorous enough, or that their own mix of coursework is rigorous.
Well, as we said, so they're one for two, which is, you know, depending on how you curve that thing. Actually, one of my favorite studies on this was, remember Tom Lovelace did that wonderful Brownstone report about 4 or 5 years ago, mm-hmm. where he interviewed foreign exchange students who spent a year in the U.S.
Yeah.
and American students who spent a year abroad. And he just ran their answers to questions, is your school harder than this typically? And the American kids all thought their year abroad was tough, and the foreign kids all thought American schools were cake.
That's right. See, that's what I'm saying. They're wrong.
Who's wrong?
The parents, the students.
Well, of course they're wrong.
Well, finally, you admit it.
But I was just saying that statistically, they had to be right on something.
You know, Rick, you're wrong.
I feel it.
Yeah.
I feel you.
Yeah, lovely. Okay, well, it is now time for our interview. Today on the show, we are very happy to have the definitive voice on the nation's report card, otherwise known as the National Assessment of Educational Progress. We are pleased to welcome NAEP 3000.
Greetings, Michael Petrilli.
Okay, NAEP 3000, let's get right to it. How do you explain the discrepancy between our students' progress in math, which has been quite dramatic, and their really lackluster progress in reading?
It is quite simple, Michael. Math involves numbers and reading involves words. Two very different things. As I always say, 2 + 2 does not equal 4. Whom the bell tolls. Ha 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 ha.
Okay, very funny. Very funny, NAEP 3000. Now tell us, why aren't we seeing more progress all around in the era of No Child Left Behind?
The answer is quite obvious. The computers are at war.
What?
In the year 2014, all children were proficient in reading and math. Computers were no longer necessary, and our race began to die out. Amidst this turmoil, an evil computer, Mamudamatin Ajot 3000, seized power. A small band of rebels sent me back in time to stop the educational progress of American children, to halt the rise of human intelligence and save our race. Thus I became NAEP 3000.
Wow. Well, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you, NAEP 3000, for answering our questions about NAEP.
You bet, Michael.
Well, Rick, what did you think about that very informative interview about the nation's report card?
Schneider wasn't available today.
So we tried Mark Schneider, Mr. National, the commissioner of the National Center on Education Statistics, did not answer Kobe's emails. We also tried a last-ditch effort to get Tom Lovelace at the Brookings Institution, but failed. So we went for the NAEP 3000.
Wow. That was, you know, it was a little bit of Terminator.
Yeah.
Little bit of The Matrix.
Uh-huh.
That was
yeah.
This is a whole lot of nothing.
This is what goes on in Kobe and Liam's mind. But seriously, let's talk a little bit about NAEP, if you don't mind here, Rick.
Sure.
All right. So a couple interesting things to note. One is, as we asked NAEP 3000, we're seeing a lot more progress in math than in reading. You have any possible explanation for why this is happening? I mean, this is over a 15-year trend line now.
Right. I mean, right. The conventional storyline is that math is something people learn in school. Kids learn in school, and that we're doing a more effective job teaching it, and that reading, of course, is embedded in a larger culture, and that children are being read to less and reading less. And so in schools, even though we arguably are making real strides on the pedagogy of teaching reading, that we're swimming against the tide.
That's interesting. You know, it also seems to me that we've been at standards-based reform in math longer. The state standards are in many cases aligned to the National Council on Teachers of Mathematics standards, and the NAEP standards are aligned to those NCTM standards as well. So you've got that curricular alignment. You've had it for a long time. That might help to explain. But one troubling thing is that you see huge progress in math on NAEP, and yet you don't see that kind of progress on the international exams, mm-hmm. on the TIMSS or the PISA. Again, what's going on here?
You know, I mean, it's the same question that crops up when you ask, when you try to figure out what makes sense when you see no NAEP improvement, but dramatic scores in state assessments. Is it that state assessments are picking up what we really care about and NAEP's not finely tuned enough? Or is it that there's some other dynamic going on? Or are we just simply testing different competencies and we're not teaching things that, you know, show up on TIMSS and PISA? I mean, these are really important questions. And I think, you know, one of the unfortunate things, there's probably only about a handful of scholars in the whole country who are well-versed enough in TIMSS and PISA and NAEP to actually try to make sense of this stuff. And so it's very rarely part of the serious conversation among policymakers.
Right. And none of those scholars were available to be interviewed today on our podcast.
And none of them happen to be sitting at this table with us right now.
All right. Well, we will try to get them on in future shows. Always interesting stuff in NAEP. It's fun to look at the trend lines, but you can come up with any story you want to explain them. Of course.
Although I do like the fact that everybody then immediately blasts out oversized 18 font press releases.
Yes.
Which is always a necessary and crucial part of helping kids learn.
This is what happens in the world of policy wonkery.
Oof.
But one last point.
Did you guys
send
out a press release tonight?
No, we did not put out a press release. There you go.
Good for you.
Talk to a few reporters. Try to be even-handed. But, you know, also did some punditry, of course.
Of course.
One last point to make is, huh? What about Massachusetts? I mean, this state continues to kick butt. It's now number one in every category. It is in fourth grade reading, beating the next state by half a grade level of reading by the fourth grade. I mean, this should be good for candidate Romney, don't you think?
That's a nice point. Yeah. No, they're Massachusetts is definitely putting something in the water.
Yep. The Massachusetts miracle coming to an election near you.
Yeah. Romney probably doesn't want to wrap himself in that. Didn't play so well last time.
What do you mean didn't play so well? Where it got President Bush elected? Texas
Massachusetts miracle?
No, the Texas miracle.
No, Massachusetts miracle last time was Dukakis. Remember, babe?
Oh, I see. That was the Massachusetts miracle.
Yeah.
I see. No, I don't go back that far. This is why you're so much older than me. I was still in high school. All right. It is now time for everyone's favorite education news of the weird. Liam, what's weird this week?
In London, they're having trouble getting boys to read. The problem? Girly book covers in colors such as lavender or lime green. Quote, publishers are getting the covers wrong, said Wendy Cooling, who works for Bookstart, an organization that encourages reading. Some stories, she continued, are perfectly attractive to boys, but they are needlessly put off. In other news, vegan teacher Dave Warwack, whose travails we reported last week, has been, quote, terminated, unquote. At the school board meeting that eventually decided his fate, Warwack accused board members of, quote, eating my friends, unquote. Unaddressed at the meeting, why Dave Warwack is friends with chicken nuggets. And that's education news of the weird.
What do you think, Rick? Would lavender or lime colors keep you from reading good books when you were a kid?
At least from, you know, carrying around the hallways in the school, man. That was a recipe for getting shoved into a locker.
Mm-hmm.
Although I got to say, I'm a big fan of Bookstart. I like organizations that encourage reading. I think that's a good thing.
Wow, Rick, you're just taking controversial positions these days, aren't you?
You got a problem with encouraging kids to read? Is that?
No, it's great. It's great. Rick, you would have, once upon a time, the Rick Hess I knew would have thought that was just too much earnestness. But now that you go up to Mamsey Pamsey Cambridge, probably have a course pack that's lavender for your students.
Oh, my.
You don't want to take any controversial positions. What has happened to the Rick Hess we used to know and love, huh? We should have a campaign. Save the old Rick Hess, huh? We should go up to Cambridge, maybe do a protest. That'd be good.
Oof. I was wondering whether Liam would be able to make a comeback from our NAEP 3000 interview, but it came back in fine fettle.
Yeah, he sounded a little bit like NAEP 3000.
He did. He delivered it, though. He delivered the goods.
He did.
The line about Warwick being friends with chicken nuggets.
Nice line.
Fabulous.
Nice line. I
haven't seen Dionne Warwick since she used to like sell stuff on late night TV. So to hear about the chicken nugget thing was fabulous. Mike, you're doing that yourself without electronic accoutrement. Fabulous.
Okay. That's right. I used to make the sounds on this show, but no, now I've been replaced.
We've gone to high tech, baby.
We've gone high tech. All right. That is all the time we have for this week. Thanks for joining us. Check us out online at edexcellence.net. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.